And welcome back to the Woodwind Legacy Series. I'm Ed Jaffe, and today we're with a friend of mine who is one of the greatest woodwind musicians in this country. And he's someone I've admired for many, many decades. Ted Nash's playing is at the highest level on all of his instruments, saxophones, clarinets, flutes. He's a terrific composer and arranger, as we'll discuss later on. But I'm particularly happy that we have him today, coincidentally, because a week ago, Ted won his first Grammy for his wonderful album called Presidential Suite. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on as well. So, Ted, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate it.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, you've been someone who has developed a very unique voice on all of your instruments, and yet you play in so many different styles that, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, it's hard for anyone to peg you or put you into just one type of style or one type of playing. But I think that's a result of how you grew up and the influences that you came up with. You are a product of basically music royalty. Your dad, Dick Nash, is one of the greatest trombone players this country has produced, and your uncle, Ted Nash Sr., also one of the finest jazz saxophone players and studio saxophonists that we've had the pleasure of listening to for many years. So growing up with that type of influence from your dad and your uncle, can you explain how you got into the woodwinds and how you got into all the woodwinds in a sense? Hmm.
Well, it's interesting because I think growing up in a musical household, I mean, not only my dad and my uncle, but my mother was a singer. And of course, their parents were all musicians. So it's a kind of thing, first of all, that you don't second guess the choice of being a musician. I think the problem with a lot of young people is they're not sure if they can make a living doing this, or their parents maybe are afraid for them, as far as you know, how they're going to sustain a lifestyle or whatever. But sort of ignorantly, it's just like, yeah, I can do this. Look at the examples that I have around me. Yeah. And my father was always happy, easygoing, enjoyed his life. So what a great example of how to live your life, but to choose something that's artistically rewarding. So that is sort of the first thing, is just having that basic support that comes from seeing the example of it.
And that's nothing, nothing to minimize, because it's huge. And I saw that as an educator for years, that unless there was total support from the family, it was very hard for any youngster to progress beyond a certain point and certainly to enter the profession.
And you probably feel also, I mean, as much, and you're such a great educator and you've been working with young kids for so long, there must be something inside of you that's a little torn about influencing and really encouraging people to go out into this world, because it can be tough, right?
Well, especially now. Even from the time that I entered the music industry, which is roughly around the time when you moved to New York in 79, 78, 79, you know, to now, and seeing the downsizing of the industry and fewer gigs, and I think the real loss has been in the minor league gigs, mm-hmm. where when you came out of school, you did certain types of job to gain footing, to gain experience. You did club dates, you learned tunes, you played in show bands, you learned how to read, how to transpose, how to play your doubles. Mm-hmm. Then maybe you went on to do shows, and then you sort of gravitated towards studio work and maybe more jazz work and more of the stuff that you were hoping to gain. Yeah. A lot of those minor league steps have disappeared. And so it's that true. You have to come out of school, or as a young person, you have to be so equipped, mm-hmm. so knowledgeable, and so proficient so early on that it's almost unnatural. It would be like an NBA basketball player coming out of high school, and only if there are only a few LeBron James or Kobe Bryants in the world. Most don't succeed on that level.
Well, there's not that many basketball club dates, so you know, it's like either you're all in or but yeah, no, I mean, and my uncle, of course, is a great woodwind player, was a great woodwind player, but my first instrument was piano, and studied classically, and then I was at summer camp and some kid pulled out a clarinet, and that was the first time I saw it up close or really thought about, wow, you can just carry this thing around with you, the piano, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But I told my dad, I love, wow, the clarinet's so cool. So he immediately rented one for me, and that was the beginning of junior high, and I started to study the clarinet. So I actually originally wanted to be a classical clarinet player, and that was what I worked sort of towards until I heard Charlie Parker, and then it was downhill from there.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly understandable, and it's a road that a number of many people found themselves doing, because clarinet was always the introduction instrument for woodwind players, whether you stayed with it and, mm-hmm. or whether you moved on to saxophone or whatnot. Clarinet, typically, in most of the 20th century, was the instrument most saxophone players played initially.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So you really had sort of a typical progression from clarinet to the saxophone, then ultimately to the flute.
Added the flute, yeah. Kind of a year each. And my teacher, Ethma Roten, who's a great studio musician, who also worked with the Henry Mancini band, he did that live TV show that they did called The Mancini Generation. And he would come in and he'd bring his Selmer tri-pack, unzip it and pull out his clarinet, his flute and his alto, yeah. and we'd do 20 minutes on each. And
really?
That was my lessons, yeah.
And how old were you at this point?
Well, that was like 13, 14.
Wow.
And I continued with him until I was probably about 16, 15 or 16.
Well, I had no idea you studied with him, but he was a formidable musician.
Amazing studio musician, played everything great.
Yeah.
Played everything great. But yeah, I used to go to my dad would take me to his studio gigs, and he would drive me through the gate. We'd get into Universal or Paramount, wherever it was, and he'd sit me in the behind the woodwind section, right in the middle of the studio when I was 13. I watched my uncle do mod squads. I used to love this. And they would have the big screen, and they would just project this huge screen with a movie on it. And my uncle would just be playing, or Mary Hartman, the Partridge Family, Cannon. I sat in so many great sessions.
Wow.
With Quincy's music. So I was intrigued, and I was so attracted to studios that I thought I would follow in the footsteps of my uncle and my father, who started out their careers as jazz musicians, touring jazz musicians, and settled into the studios. And I've sort of done the opposite. I've gone from wanting and doing more commercial music, shows, and some studio work, to really being a full-time jazz musician. I think my father is getting quite a vicarious thrill out of that,
because
that's how he started.
That's amazing. And it should be noted what I said in the introduction, for instance, your uncle, Ted Nash Sr., was the star tenor saxophonist of the Les Brown Band. I mean, these weren't just good working musicians. Your dad and your uncle were stars in those days.
It's interesting because my uncle, he passed away about 6 years ago, but when I used to talk to him about this, it always seems like he had his design on the studios, that this was a path, this was a way to get there, because he saw how big band musicians, Henry Mancini is a typical example of that. I mean, someone who was playing in big band and doing arranging for big band and ended up in the studios. And my uncle, at a certain point in the late 40s, the Downbeat poll came out, and he was four on tenor, right behind Lester Young, who was number three. So there was that point when he had the choice to go this way or that way, and he went that way.
I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. But what a way to grow up and be surrounded by situations like that. I mean, a little bit, from what I know of, Tom Scott had a little bit of that as well, being introduced to the studios early on with his dad and all. So, I mean, with that type of influence and the type of teacher that you're, I mean, that's also a wonderful thing that you were brought to such a master at such a young age. I mean, to find a teacher like that for a 13 or 14-year-old mm-hmm. is not typical. But I guess, your family's knowledge of who's out there and who would be a good teacher, gave you that opportunity. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was just someone my father was currently working with. They were doing the Mancini TV show, and he goes, yeah, I'll hook you up with Ethmer. And I've got like all sorts of stuff on my jacket. I feel like I've just spilled food on it or something.
No cats around, so I don't know. So when did, I mean, ultimately saxophone became your major instrument as far as, what you were pegged as. You were pegged as a saxophonist. And the mm-hmm. fact that you also were a very capable doubler opened up opportunities. But when did you get into the saxophone in a way that you said, this is going to be my prime voice?
Probably as I got into high school, and I studied with a teacher named Charlie Shoemake, who's a vibes player who played with George Shearing for a while, had a method of teaching jazz, which was very simple. It was just that you had to memorize a solo, transcribed solo for every lesson, which was once a week. So for a period of a couple of years, from age 14 to about 16, I memorized probably, I would say easily, 70 or 80 solos. And that's Bird, Hank Mobley, Sonny Rollins, Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, you name it. So that, without even thinking about it, you're developing a language. I mean, I was too young to even improvise. I mean, really, it was hard for me to put it together. But at some point around 15, it clicked. My teacher even talks about it. He says, my first 6 months of studying with him, he'd leave the room, hey, you know, why don't you practice on this a little bit? I'm going to go get some water or something. He'd leave the room, close the door, and kiss his wife and say, whew, I don't know about this one, because I just couldn't figure it out. And then all of a sudden, I got it, and I could start playing. And by 16, I was doing gigs and playing bebop, and maybe it wasn't necessarily anything that was very personal or inventive or whatever, but I could play, I could go up, you know, and just play choruses of bebop lines and all of that. So I think probably around 15, I became absolutely in love with playing jazz, and that became sort of more my focus at
right.
that point.
And was alto your prime saxophone at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, and people identify me more on the alto, no matter when I've tried to quit the alto. I've tried to tell everybody, I'm a tenor player. I've right. tried to not play the alto, yeah. but you just keep coming back
right.
to it.
So. Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because is concerning the alto and tenor and your voice on each, which is very different. And that's very unusual. I have found only in my experience very few people who play both alto and tenor equally well and with different voices. I mean, Sonny Stitt obviously comes to mind. Also for me, Dick Oates, mm-hmm. when Dick was playing more tenor, also comes to mind. But I mean, that's not easy to do. Is there something you do on a conscious level to differentiate the instruments, or was it something that just evolved naturally for you?
It was just funny because I started the alto and I was playing the alto, and then my dad brought home this tenor sax. Hey man, it's time you, that's what he did every year. He's all bring a new horn home and said, it's time you, dot, dot, dot. Okay. I was like, ooh, the tenor. It's got a lower thing. It's more human voice range. It feels, yeah. it could be darker. It feels softer. It feels like you can caress it. The alto for me always, you know, thinking about Cannonball, Phil Woods, and Ornette, it just that kind of brighter, forward-moving, a lot of sound. With tenor, I feel like you have more options in terms of how you shape your sound as a tenor player. Look at the differences in the way tenor players sound, and I feel like, or the broader range of accepted sort of tenor sounds, I think, versus the alto. I think it's changed a lot with some of the great alto players have come out since, you know, the last 30 years, but it's funny because I just feel like different people on the different instruments. So it's a little schizo if I go back and forth. Lately, because of my job with Jazz at Lincoln Center, we do 8 or 9 months worth of work throughout the year, and I'm playing alto. So I don't even touch the tenor for months at a time now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. But so who were your, I mean, you alluded to so many of the great alto players, Bird and Cannonball and Phil and Ornette. Who were your primary, if you could isolate the primary influences on alto and then on tenor, and then maybe we'll talk about maybe some of the recordings that you found helpful and maybe that you offer to students as a means for grabbing a hold of the language in a better way.
Well, it's funny because, and maybe this is being young, but I always wanted to be hit over the head with people's sound and their swing and their whole style. So Cannonball and Phil and this type of playing for me was very attractive. Whereas like say Art Pepper or Paul Desmond, I was kind of even my uncle, which my parents kept saying, "You got to check out your uncle some more." I was like, "Yeah," you know, because it felt to me a little light. It just felt a little light and easy, and that whole West Coast versus East Coast
right,
thing.
Right.
But it took me about 10 or 12 years to suddenly discover on my own my uncle, Paul Desmond, and different kinds of players that later did become part of the language or part of the influences on me. But not in the beginning. I just wanted to, like, it had to be hard bop. It had to be swinging hard bop with that big bright sound. And Phil Woods, I loved him so much. And Cannonball. So that was the thing. With tenor, though, I felt like there was a little bit more of a variety of what I was attracted to. I mean, Sonny Rollins, probably my still all-time favorite tenor player. My uncle did not like his sound, loved his technique and his harmony, but he just didn't like his sound. I like his sound. Hank Mobley, also kind of an interesting sound. I think a lot of people feel it's sort of tubby, it's sort of dark, but he was the perfect player. He never played a wrong note. It was like everything was poetic, it was perfect. He felt like he was just always making his phrases instead of, it was so easy, like with Coltrane, it's like, you know, he could play anything. And of course, Coltrane and Lockjaw Davis at a certain point, Coleman Hawkins. Later, I sort of circled back around and started finding more of the swing players, which I didn't also pay that much attention to because I started coming with a hard bop.
Sure. I think that's not uncommon. After you've lived enough years and remain committed to the instrument that you start recognizing, hey, those old guys could really play. I know for myself, some of the alto players like Willie Smith, Buster Smith, are fantastic. And of course, some of the lead alto players like Les Robinson and Toots Mandello, and then of course, Marshall Royal. I mean, it's just magnificent to be reawakened to these great players who may not get the same press, let's say, as Bird or Hodges or Benny Carter, but have something equally magnificent.
Like Earl Bostick.
Unbelievable.
Who's like unbelievable player.
Yeah.
But he had his thing.
He didn't get the press, or certainly aren't talked about as enough. But that's interesting. So, can you cite on alto and tenor some of your favorite recordings that might be helpful for our listeners who are, you know, getting into playing the saxophone? That might be, you know, really seminal type of recordings that you can cite.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about Cannonball, you can't go wrong with anything, really. I mean, Cannonball and Coltrane records, Something Else, his record with Miles on it. Those two, of course, Kind of Blue. Those are probably records that I spend the most time with listening to Cannonball. He did a record with Bill Evans.
Right.
That's beautiful. He does Waltz for Debbie and Four.
Yes. That's the one with Who Cares on it, I think, as well, maybe.
And with Phil... You know, he had a certain charm about him, like his early playing from the 50s, where he was really coming out of Bird, but he was finding his own sort of way of swinging, which I really liked, and the sound had a real beautiful, pure quality to it. Yes. Bright, but pure, right?
Well, I think those were the days he was also playing, if I'm not incorrect, he was playing a super balanced. Before he switched in the early 60s to the Mark VI.
Oh, okay. I thought he played a balanced. Was that later? Or was that earlier?
The earlier ones, it was about a super balance, you know, one of the later balances. But he played balanced in the 50s, and then I remember him telling me that he switched to the Mark VI when he was in France. Marcel Mule actually picked out his Mark VI.
Oh, that's
for
so
him.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I know that he was. I don't know if he was an expat really, but I think he just found more interest. Maybe it was the time to be in Europe, but in a way, because of that, his records were coming out and we were hearing them, but he wasn't getting the kind of presence that he was getting earlier, I think that, or later. And I think that when he moved back to New York, remember, do you know the Live at Jimmy's record with Michelle LeGrand?
Absolutely, yeah, You Must Believe in Spring.
It's like one of the greatest. Most amazing solos.
Absolutely.
And when I heard that, I was like, I was an instant Phil Woods fan. And that was when I started to memorize some of that solo. Yeah. And I called him up I called him up when he was living in the Gap. Yeah. And I said, man, what was going on? He had played that beautiful cadenza with all that kind of Slaninsky sort of pattern stuff all that. He goes, yeah, man. He says, I came back from Europe and I was sleeping on Jerry Dodgen's couch. And Jerry got the call. And Jerry was busy. He goes, oh, I got some great alto players staying with me right now, Phil Woods. And so he did the gig.
Right.
And he goes, you know, but I had to come up with some new shit, man, you know, because I was back in New York. And
that's sort of the way I could hear him saying that too. But it's so funny you mentioned that album because I remember the cover, the purplish type of cover. Oh, I remember that vividly.
Yeah.
And I think for alto sax players, especially when you're in the college period.
Yeah.
It was like trumpet players in the college period were Maynard freaks. Mm-hmm. I know for myself, I was followed him around, and anytime he came to New York, I went to hear Phil and the various groups that he had, the permutations of him, and that period. And then when he recorded Live at the Showboat, I thought it was also one of the greatest.
Very similar kind of.
Yeah, that same thing.
His enthusiasm and his swing and his technique, everything, I think he was like at the height of his playing.
Yeah, I agree.
Which lasted, but still.
Yeah.
But, you know, being in L.A., it wasn't New York, but there were a lot of great musicians in L.A., and a lot of bands would come through. And I used to go hear Super Sax when I was in high school. And Warren Marsh would play in that band.
Yes.
And so I got to hear him live. Arthur Blythe would come through and play Dante's. And when I heard Arthur Blythe live, I was like, there's a whole new way of playing. That opened me up. I loved it. Then Cedar Walton would come in and play Dante's. And he had his band with Billy Higgins and Bob Berg.
Oh.
And when I heard Bob Berg, I was 16. I was in high school. And Bob Berg was probably in his early 20s at that point. He'd already done Horace Silver.
Yeah, he would have been about 25, I think, at that point. 25, 26.
Yeah, he's probably about 10 years. He was about 10 years older than me.
Yes.
And he was part of a whole, it felt like a movement of New York, you know, tenor players that were post-Coltrane, like with Liebman, Brecker, Bob Mincer, I think, is sort of part of that league, Steve Grossman.
Sure.
Unbelievable, with this energy, and of course, talking about get hit over your head, Bob Berg would come in and just drive it through, and he was a god to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned his name, and I hope a lot of listeners who may not be as familiar with Bob Berg will go out and seek some of his albums and really listen to him. I don't think there was ever any time I ever heard him play that it wasn't full of energy. Mm-hmm. I mean, but harmonically sophisticated. And I actually remember hearing him, believe it or not, he was a few years older than me, he was at Performing Arts High School in Manhattan. And even then, as a high school kid, playing soprano and tenor, it was scary.
Yeah.
It was very scary.
Amazing.
You know, when you say, oh my goodness, is that the level? And then you realize there are only a few on that level.
Yeah.
But that's wonderful. Thanks for mentioning him.
Oh, and nice.
And so now back to your clarinet and flute, since mm-hmm. My website is basically concerned with woodwind playing and doubling as a corollary. Where did your clarinet evolve to after you began it and you got hooked on the saxophone? Were you continuing to study or play it, or did it sort of take a back seat and for a number of years? And
I don't know if it took a back seat. I always played it. I always liked playing it. I never liked improvising on it that much. So it was because maybe I always thought of it as more of a classical instrument for me. It came in handy, of course, playing in big bands like the Mel Lewis Band or bands that would use doubles, which most of the bands today do. I mean, you really have to play fairly well on the clarinet and flute.
And especially your job at Jazz at Lincoln Center, which is probably the most working big band, certainly in our country, and one of the greatest jazz gigs one can have, I think. And but you, with all the different types of musics and concerts, like you told me last night, you folks played a concert of music based on the 50s.
Right.
And then, you know, you'll go back and play concerts of Ellington music and then original music from the members. I mean, mm-hmm. my goodness, the amount of doubling that you do is really quite impressive in that
orchestra.
Well,
it's interesting because as Wynton started, because he was the first one to start writing for the band, he started to realize that people had certain skills on certain instruments, like Victor Goins is a remarkable clarinet player. Sherman Irby plays great flute. We even played a piece last night that had Walter Blanding playing oboe on a piece.
Wow.
I mean, he doesn't really play it all that much, but, you know, he got a vibe on it. I played piccolo. We all had little solos. Piccolo, Sherman played alto flute. So yeah, we're using a lot of doubles as extensions of the artistic and creative writing that people are doing, not so much as a commercial thing. For a long time, and you've been in this world doing commercial music for so long, studio work and all the show work that you've done. You have to play the flute and clarinet and piccolo at a high level. And I felt like the clarinet, I was always fine with. I always felt like the clarinet, I could handle pretty much whatever would come in front of me. But the flute, for a long time, I felt like I was lacking in terms of, like, I like playing the flute, I could solo on it, I always played it. But when I saw people like you and a lot of friends who played the flute at a different level, like, they really took this seriously. And I realized that for me to be able to do that kind of work, I had to get better. So I spent more time practicing the flute, not a whole lot, but I mean really just trying to focus on trying to get a better sound and be able to play up high really smoothly and maybe get the piccolo. I bought a better piccolo and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So at a certain point I felt like I could play the flute pretty well. I don't think I'm a convincing like classical flute player, but I mean I can play in tune. I can play technically what's called upon, but I never really felt like I could play convincingly well as a classical flute player.
Well, that being said, I remember sitting next to you at, excuse the expression, the show Cats, where you ended up taking over the lead book, which had some big flute solos and solos that would come after some hard tenor playing.
Mm-hmm.
it wasn't an easy flute double on those shows, and you did just unbelievably well. You sounded really fantastic, and it was, and I remember being surprised, saying, "How could someone who's such a great jazz player play such great flute?" And I mean, doing all the work that Ted does, and you know, I was blown away. And this was, I think, sort of in the late '80s.
It probably was early 90s.
Early 90s was...
Because I think okay. I did that in the last 9 years when it closed in 2000. I'm not afraid to talk about that. That was an important time. I was able to raise kids. I think because of that show, because I came into that show feeling, okay, I'm hanging in there on the flute, I developed TMJ.
Really?
Because I was playing the flute every day, which I hadn't done.
I see.
And I started to get extreme pain. I remember Eddie Salkin saying, "Wow, you know, you're jutting your jaw too much," or some, you know, people would say to me. So I used that show as an opportunity to relearn how to create an embouchure that wasn't putting so much pressure on my jaw. So I came in and I started relaxing, and I played the solos, and for a few weeks I felt like I had a lot of air. I couldn't really get the sound I wanted, but I was absolutely set on refocusing my embouchure so that I wouldn't have a problem, and I got through it. I think my flute playing got better as a result of being in that show, for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting, because I remember talking to Bob Minzer, who also ended up playing in that show for a while.
I sat next to him for a little while.
Right, he had some ridiculous piccolo stuff to play that book, and he did, everyone knows Bob they know Minzer, is a great tenor player, great writer, arranger, bass clarinet, but he did great on piccolo. I mean, spectacular.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, a show can be beneficial if you treat it in the way of like, well, how can I improve my playing of the instrument from even just from a technical point of view? Because the music obviously becomes so much the same that the monotony of that can break you down. But if you look at treating your instrument and finding new ways of playing it, or maybe a mouthpiece and a reed combination will allow you to do something, or a head joint will allow you to do something that your other head joint didn't. I mean, you can really learn from that scenario.
And you can also learn about how to respect and appreciate what you have, because a lot of people maybe have the personality, it's like, man, doing the same thing every night, oh, this is sucks, or, you know, whatever. Well, you create a negative energy around what you do, and of course you're not going to be happy.
Yes.
People say, how could you do that night after night? Well, I did miss a lot of it, but still, even if I did a couple weeks in a row, like 16 shows, I was happy to have the opportunity to try to improve my playing, to try to play the best that I could play every time I play it.
Right.
I think that's what you have. You have an opportunity, even if you're playing the same music, I'm going to try to play the best that I can at all times.
Right.
And if you have that attitude going into whatever you do, you're going to be happier because you're not putting it down. You're not putting your own environment down.
And
you're creating a positive energy for the people around you. I mean, you know, you've sat next to people who have a negative attitude. But you have that kind of pride about the way you play. Like, Will Rogers Follies, maybe the first time I met you, and you had so much pride in terms of like being the best that you can. It wasn't like an ego thing. It was just like, I want to play the best that I can, and that's very inspiring.
Right. Well, you know, I think the other thing that comes through is like, you know, being in New York at a time when the recording industry was still vibrant, and we had so many great players based here and playing all the time, and we had the studio orchestras, the Tonight Show Band, and hearing all those guys, and the pride that they carried themselves with. And also there, I found that a generation older than myself were guys who were still studying. They would, in 50 years old, 60 years old, they'd go study.
Right.
They would continually look to improve themselves. One of the earlier interviews I did was with Keith Underwood, the great flutist. And Keith, in that interview, talked about Sid Cooper coming to him as he was already in his 70s.
Wow.
And he said, you know, I'm not playing as well. I need help. I've got to find to play the way I used to play. And I thought that was just terrific. I know I've tried, and people who I respect, like yourself, always when that horn goes in your mouth, that's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't care about the way you sound on play, then I think that reflects something deeply about the individual.
Right.
Yes, the music may not be great. It may be boring. It may not be well arranged. I mean, you can't always play Henry Mancini or Billy Byers or Ralph Burns arrangements.
That's true.
You know, those are the rare opportunities.
And, you know, you come out of high school, college. I don't know that many people who set out to do Broadway shows as a career. Like, that's why they got into music. But a lot of people understand that that's a good thing to do. But I think we all either we have desire to be a great classical player or a jazz player or do something on an artistic level. That's why we get attracted to music to begin with, the artistic side of it. It's not like we were in junior high school thinking about, I can't wait to do Broadway shows. I mean, there are people who probably do that.
And more and more yeah. Today there are because of the diminishing amount of work.
Well, now we look at it as, God, I hope I can do some Broadway shows because, and look at the way the studios have changed in the last 25 years. You had such a high level of musicianship in the studios because there was a lot of work and it attracted all the best players. And yes. The shows sometimes didn't get the A-level players.
That's
because
right.
It was considered B-level work.
Right.
As the studio thing went down, now all the studio players are trying to get shows. And now the level of the studio orchestra, I mean the
Broadway,
the pit,
yeah.
is very high. So of course it's a great place to want to be because you're
right.
around great musicians.
It's true.
And as a jazz musician or a classical musician or whatever art that you're doing, this enables you, gives you an opportunity to pay your bills, improve some basic musicianship and meet
right.
people. I mean, I think it's a great place to
right.
to work.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's something that a young player should recognize who set out with Broadway as their goal, that yes, it's a fine thing to do, you can develop and everything. But I also think that one has to have aspirations on an artistic level
mm-hmm.
beyond the gig.
Mm-hmm.
Because if your goal is just to get the gig, just to do that type of work, and not to have a higher, I guess we're getting into a more philosophical discussion, but if you're limited to just achieving the gig, getting called for the job and surviving on it, I think that affects the way you sound and you play in a negative way. There always has to be, I think, something else there for you to keep striving for.
Well, it's human nature, right? To always want to be better or...
Right.
To achieve more, you don't just have a goal and you're 24 and you get into the pit and now you've done, you're great, you're happy for the rest of your life. You're always going to, as just by human nature, want to, whether it's like a writing project or start, you're always going to be thinking about what can I do now, how can I do more, be more creative, create more. So that's our human nature, yeah. And I
right.
think that the Broadway show is a great place to develop your musician, your basic skills. It's a great place to earn a living and meet people. And then
to build from.
Yeah, definitely. But you're also part of a very viable and important art form itself. So, I mean, there's some great stuff coming out of it.
And now, segueing to your situation where you just received the Grammy, well-deserved for this fantastic album, Presidential Suite, which you... wrote and arranged yourself, you conducted, you have a beautiful feature on soprano on one of the tracks as well. How did that all evolve? I mean, you're writing and arranging, which is not just for small group, which you've done on many of your albums and groups, collective groups, but now this is your third big band album, and that's a very different foray and a very different demand. How did that evolve for you as a big band composer and arranger?
Basically, it started when I was in the Mel Lewis Jazz Orchestra, and when I moved to New York, Thad and Mel had just split up, but I was a big fan of Thad's writing, and so when I joined the Mel Lewis Jazz Orchestra, just hearing all that great music by Thad, by Bob Brookmeyer. Bob Minster was contributing a lot to the orchestra at the time, and Jerry Dodgen. I was hearing really great music, and I wanted to be able to do that. It was sort of like, boy, it'd be great to be able to do that. It was almost like this unreachable, magical thing. You know that feeling you get sometimes, like, if I could just have this magical ability. It's like speaking another language.
Sure.
I wish I could speak French fluently or some other language. I just, I don't. And it just feels like this magical thing. So writing for big band felt like that. So I just started doing it. Mel was very encouraging, although we never rehearsed. So you'd sight read the thing at the Vanguard, which could be some kind of an experience. But
so you didn't actually, I mean, your innate musicianship came out here. But I mean, as far as you hadn't really studied arranging or jazz arranging, as today in all the schools, they have very specific courses with, and there's so many wonderful books available now that deal with arranging, but you did it more as an organic thing, a natural evolution.
Yeah, but your ears tell you. I think ultimately it comes down to what you hear, and you can hear a voicing that works. You can hear call and response. You can hear the things. I can hear the way Mintzer creates a voicing that is very satisfying to listen to. Maybe I don't know what it is right away, but as I work on it, I can say, okay, that's the sound, or that's the sound. You know, the drop to this and that. I mean, I never really used any kind of methods or anything like that. I'll have read a number of books at a certain point. No, I never did study. But like anything else, you can learn on a bandstand, or you can basically learn as you work on it. And I imagine a lot of great composers didn't study.
Mintzer himself.
Yeah.
It came out of the Buddy Rich Band. Where
yeah.
He just had a
he buddy. He started doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you have an affinity for it, you'll find a way to do it. So, you know, some of the charts I brought in sucked, but that was part of the learning experience. With Jazz at Lincoln Center, Winton understood that I did some writing, and so he said, hey, man, could you cover a couple of pieces for this project, for this theme, or whatever? We did these theme concerts, whether it was like jazz meets flamenco, the music of John Coltrane, or you know, some kind of a theme.
And let me interject, there's one a few years ago you did with Chick Corea.
Right.
And by the way, as far as flute playing, there's one track that's up on YouTube, and I forget which tune, maybe it was Windows. Yes, and you have an extended flute solo that's really to drop dead for. It's fantastic.
Thanks.
And I remember calling you and asking to get that arrangement that we did with my university
That's
band
right.
after I heard
That's
that.
Right.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the Jazz at Lincoln Center gig has really given you that many more opportunities.
Right,
to
and there was only a couple of us that were writing in the beginning, and then Winton said, hey, and then we had a project, I think it was all nursery rhymes was the theme of the show, nursery rhyme theme, and he says, I want everybody to write an arrangement who wants to try or can. So it was Carlos Enriquez, Ollie Jackson's, their first arrangements they ever wrote were for these concerts. And it's been great to see everybody from Sherman Irby, Chris Crenshaw, to Walter Blanding, writing arrangements. We have 11 people in the band who are contributing to the repertoire.
Wow.
I've never been in a band that had that many arrangers. You might have a couple or one main one. So that's been a very interesting experience. And Winton and Jazz Lincoln Center commissions different members of the band, not just members of the band, but people outside the band as well, but to write full-length, full-set, hour-long pieces. And so Presidential Suite came out of one of those commissions.
Wow. You know,
we premiered it in early 2014, and Victor
right.
Goins' piece called Crescent City Suite was the other half, a beautiful piece of music that Branford was our guest on and played.
Right.
Yeah.
And just as a little promo, because I really think this is an important album, not because it won the Grammy and not just because Ted did all the music for this, but I think in our world, it's always important to reflect back on brilliant minds and intellects, and you've done that with your album. And can you just talk a little bit about the genesis of the work, which comes from these magnificent speeches by great individuals?
It was a coming together of a lot of important experiences of my life. The first one I have to say is just being brought up by parents who were very open-minded, and they were civil rights activists and of course musicians. So our home was open to everybody, and excuse me, I think that has always stayed with me. That's just the struggle for human rights, civil rights, has always been something that was important to me, whether I was very active or not at different times. So as I began to plan what this music was going to be, I started thinking about how speeches in general and rhetoric, first of all, the nature of rhetoric is so different. But I found that I was attracted to the theme of freedom, like the speeches that really moved me, that gave me goosebumps, all were dealing with the theme of freedom. And this was Democrats, Republicans. It wasn't a political statement for me. Right. It wasn't like, oh, I just want to use liberal. I mean, my politics are liberal, but I mean, it wasn't a political statement. So, you know, Reagan's tear down this wall speech, Churchill, who was a Republican, his find the beaches speech. So it was really about speeches that dealt with this theme. And I transcribed all the speeches also for their actual pitches, and I created all the thematic material. So the melodies of all the pieces are actually literally the speeches themselves.
Right. And were the rhythms of the way the speakers delivered them and influential at all in that as well?
A little bit, but that was one place that I had to sort of be flexible. I had to stretch things or compress them. Right. I put JFK's first inauguration speech, Ask Not, in the context of an F blues. Now, no one actually speaks in any particular key. It's very atonal.
Right.
Or it's not tonal. It's not key-centered. So, you know, to be able to figure out a way to put all the different tones and figure out chords and harmony for it throughout this record was extremely challenging, but I didn't want it to sound stiff or anything. So, even if people don't know about that, I still wanted the music to stand up. So it required a lot of work, but I feel very gratified doing the kind of work that I did
right.
for it.
And the beautiful thing is that the speeches are also delivered not only by the original speakers, but also by some people who you brought into the project. I mean, we're talking about some major names. I mean, you had Glenn Close yeah. come in. You had former Senator Joe Lieberman
yeah.
come in and deliver. I mean, it's a unique album and a different perspective, but the playing, the band sounds just great. And really, everybody
Thanks.
Plays...
This band is amazing.
And it's recorded beautifully. I generally don't try to use these interview times to promote, do the DJ thing. But this is a unique situation. And
we're in a unique time. This is a very unique time.
Yes. And I think any musician out there would do well to listen to this music. I think buying the CD as a whole, this is not a CD you want to buy and stream, I think, in my opinion. You want the product because there's a lot to be said, and the accompanying booklet is large, detailed, and full of information. And if there's any album to buy in its entirety, in the hard copy, I think this is it. So,
thanks.
I really feel like...
It's got two CDs because one has just the music and then one has the speeches also.
Right,
the speeches
right.
are just a minute and a half excerpts and they serve as intros to each of the piece. But what I really would love, and this is the what I hope to gain the most from this record, is that people will listen to these excerpts and speeches and be reminded of something and maybe go back and listen to these speeches in their entirety and think, wow, this speech was in 1941, and this speech was in 1965, and this speech, and look at, how far we have come in a lot of ways, but how much we still have to do,
right?
In terms of human rights around the world. It's a reminder, and again, I don't want to make people feel like, oh, suddenly they have this huge responsibility, but just hopefully it will inspire people.
Yeah, and it's I had no idea beforehand. I just purchased it because, quite frankly, I was preparing for the interview with you and I wanted to see what you were up to in your latest project. And I was stunned. I just had no idea going into it. I, went in blind and that's, in a way, sometimes that's the best way because then when you find a situation like this, it means that much more. Getting back to your playing, the woodwind playing, you mentioned that piano was your first instrument, and I know you really play piano quite well. In fact, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, though, a couple of times at Cats, you were taking off at night, and maybe I was even subbing for you at that point, and you were doing club dates on piano.
Oh,
I mean, you have real chops, and obviously tremendous harmonic knowledge, and certainly know the American songbook very well. Can you speak to how piano playing influences your woodwind playing, your improvising, in a direct way,
Well, I think the piano, I think it's a great instrument to start on because you get a couple of different clefs and you learn about independence and reading and just basic music stuff that's suggested by the material that you'll be looking at on piano. But it's such a great tool for orchestrating. I wish I were a better piano player. I wish I did some gigs on the piano, but I mean, if I look at it, I was just hanging in there. But I love the piano, and I sometimes I'll sit at the piano and play chords and stuff and play along with it because you hear the resonance and the overtones, and the piano will give you a good idea of how overtones come together and how they work and how they don't. And like if you put clusters together down low, how it rubs a certain way, maybe it's not going to sound good in a trombone section. It gives you a good idea. It's a pretty good guide in terms of orchestrating, so I really like it for that. To sit at the piano, hit a high G, and then play the flute and listen to how you can get in tune with a high G or whatever, and really try to, it's not just getting in tune, but really resonating with the sound and the vibration of the piano makes you want to ring out it. So there's a lot you can get from using the piano. Right. I do use it a lot for orchestrating. I find that it could be considered a crutch to some people to use the piano because maybe you feel limited to how much you can play on the piano. But if you can get most of your ideas away from the piano and think about it and really hear it, and then maybe use the piano as a tool to find the right orchestrations on certain things, because you do get a good idea about the overtone series and about the balance of things. But I do wish I could play it better as an instrument.
Well, I think we'd all wish to play it as well as you do, because you really do play, quite well. And I think that's also something that needs to be said. Regardless if you're a jazz musician or a commercial player or a classical player, the ability to play piano is essential to develop as a musician. And it was my first instrument, too, and I also have regrets not continuing study as well. And maybe now that I have little more focus in my life, maybe I can do that more. But it is the instrument to build upon, and I'm so glad you referred to it as that. Mm. So when you're learning a tune or learning a new piece of music that requires you to improvise,
mm-hmm.
So someone else has written a piece of music, and you're going to have a feature on it, and these are not based on a standard tune or changes that don't move in any sequential type of way, but I mean, you have to really study. What is your process that you go through in learning a tune or learning new material in which mm-hmm. you're going to improvise on?
Well, there's so many different, there's learning tunes, which is like learning a standard, and when I teach or when I get a student to learn a new tune, I have them do it without looking at music, rather just hear the song, learn the melody, because things, for me, I think this is the case with most people, is that when you use your ears, you learn something and you memorize it better than when you use your eyes. We talk about Cats, I did that for 9 years. I turned a page once, I turned too many pages, and I couldn't remember what I was supposed to play. I was floundering. I couldn't remember what my part was.
I know that feeling.
I just never memorized a note of it, and it's because I use my eyes all the time to play it. If someone just teaches you, here, okay, here's the melody. Da do de do do da, or you get that da do ba do do da. Okay, got that. Now that's never going to leave you because you've played it, you've listened to it.
Right.
It's like when you meet somebody. Hi, my name is John. John, and you say the name John, and you look at them in the face, you're going to remember their name.
Right.
So there's something that you hear it, you play it, you're going to memorize it more. Now that's more about learning the melody. And it's, I remember Bob Mover saying to me when I was still maybe a late teen, he says you got to learn the lyrics to every song.
Yes, that's a big thing with Bob, and it still is, and it's a wonderful thing. It's actually, I was talking about, that's very funny you mentioned about Bob, because he's a dear friend, and he just played a few weeks ago over at Birdland, and I was talking about this with Roger Rosenberg, as a mm-hmm. matter of fact, and Roger was saying, when I said, when he was teaching at my university, made every student learn the lyric to every tune and would call them on it if they didn't. And Roger said, that's an old school mm-hmm. approach. Older musicians did that. They didn't have anyone telling them at school. That was just the natural way guys in the 30s and the 40s, when they learned the tunes, they learned the lyrics. It was all one and the same.
But you were listening to people sing. You were listening to, you're getting, going to the shows or watching the movies or listening to Frank Sinatra, and you heard the lyrics. I'm not very good with lyrics. I actually don't memorize them or or hear them very well when I'm listening to songs. So a lot of the songs I learned was like listening to Miles Davis, you know, Funny Valentine live at Carnegie Hall or something, and it's like, all right, of course I'm not going to play the melody right, because he was using it as a basis for something, but he wasn't playing the melody or singing it. So
right.
It's great advice. I don't know that many lyrics. I mean, I know, you know, you could take Stella
right.
and say, the song a robin sings through years of endless springs, the murmur of a brook
at eventide. That
ripples past the brook, the nook where two lovers hide.
That's right.
But it's like a struggle because yeah. I never worked on it like that. And I think it's great right. advice because you understand yeah. about the phrasing of the song. Like, I know we're talking about like the harmony and all that, but just the basic thing. First of all, the melody right. and how you phrase it, body and soul. My heart is
sad and lonely.
So you know you repeat that note. Da da. But a lot of like people will take a ballad like that and they'll start adding pieces to the melody that don't exist. Not that it's wrong, but it's so important that you just know that pure melody and you just be able to play it and put all your expression through without adding any notes. I think it's the first step is to learn the melody exactly the way it is, whether that's using the lyrics or just listening to someone sing or play it, rather than learning it, say, through a jazz performance of it, because you're not going to learn the original phrasing of it. The melody will also inform you a lot about the harmony, because the melody notes often hit certain parts of the chord that do tell you what the quality of that chord. But Stella, it's pretty much a B flat scale. Okay, it goes away there. But you go to the bridge, it lands on a note that is a very specific, it's a sharp five on a dominant chord. So it suggests a certain type of harmony that you would play on the bridge. Okay, it keeps going. Now at the end, it goes to that flat five, yeah, half diminished chord. That informs you a little bit about the certain harmony. There's not that many examples of where in Stella the melody really tells you, but there are some, and for most songs the melody will give you a clue about the quality of the chord. I mean, we'll learn the chords, they'll be written out, but to really be able to play a song, you have to get a real intimate understanding of the chord structure. I mean, a lot of times we play on gigs and we don't have a chance to really learn and get intimate with a song. We're reading the chords, we see a dominant chord, we see this, we see a major chord, we see a and we're trying to make sense of the cadence of it, but we don't have maybe enough opportunity to really discover the through cadence of everything until we've sat down and worked with it. So it's really important that people look at a song and look at the cadences, where the 5-1s are, because that's an important part of, especially with standard tunes, of how you create tension and release, and how you can find poetic harmonic qualities in the 5 chords often. That's where a lot of really interesting things happen. And so to do that, we have to look at each cadence or each 5 chord and understand what it is. If you look at Stella, E half diminished to A7. That A7 is like an A altered. It's as if it's an A7 going to 1.
Right.
So you play it like it's an A7 altered or going to 1, but it doesn't. It
right.
shifts at the last minute. So then you got C minor to F7. Now the F7 is a 5 chord that's not going to 1, and you don't treat it as a 5 going to 1. It's got like a sharp 11, it's got that other sound, a different kind of like melodic minor, whatever. Then you have F minor, B flat, and the B flat 7 goes to E flat. So the first time out of 3 2-5-1s in a row, you actually only have one that actually resolves.
Yeah, yeah.
One pretends to resolve, one doesn't pretend to resolve, and then one does. So it's like each one of those presents a different way of looking at the 5 chord. So you have to understand that if you're going to play on the tune. And it's like that with anything, just getting an intimate understanding. It's like I'll have students look at the song Bolivia by Cedar Walton.
Yes.
And you've got the 16 bars of a G7 sus. And then you've got like chord after chord right. after chord after chord.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are cadences. Sometimes they're a little hidden, they're tritones. And I was surprised by how many, even more of my advanced students, didn't see the cadence in a lot of the cases. They didn't see the 5-1s that existed throughout that. So it's good to take a song like that and really break it down and analyze it. And then you can go from there. I mean, I think you look at the basic harmony of a chord and suggested harmony of a chord, and you come up with a scale, and that's a good place to start. That scale works, and how can you use it, and you can practice it. But we listen to someone like Joe Henderson, who has such a deep understanding of the harmony. He goes past that. He understands all that, and then he can put his own stamp on it. And that's where you want to get as an artist. You want to be able to understand the basic harmony, the basic implications of the harmony, and own it. And then you can then you can put your own thing on it.
Interesting.
It's a process, and it takes a while.
And much of what you're saying, which Bob Mover always said, also comes from Bob's influences, which were Lee Konitz. Mm-hmm. And Tristano always emphasized the purity of, as far as I understand, I never had the honor of studying with Lee or certainly Tristano, but apparently, you know, really approaching the tunes in a somewhat classical way, a pure melody, pure harmony, really being able to know the lyrics, know everything you can about the tune before you really can create something.
let's take Stella. Let me see if this is wet enough. Right? So I sometimes look at a couple different ways to play, and that's a global way or a local way. And a global way is just like how the melody suggests, which is like you stay in one sort of tonal center, and you don't really make a big deal out of the chords. You're playing more sort of over the top of everything. Like if I take Stella. Right? I didn't even play anything outside of a B-flat scale. That's sort of a global way of playing. It's just playing very melodically, and I'm not ignoring the chords, but I'm not making a big deal out of all the cadences, as opposed to more local ways where I'm really dealing with each chord. Right? So then I'm really addressing the cadences and I'm using them. So that's sort of more the local way. So just having the ability to go back and forth between global and local is important too.
Right. But that takes a total knowledge, not only of the tune, but of harmonies and the implications. So it really requires, what we're saying is, there's a lot of knowledge that goes into this and a lot of serious study to be able to have the freedom then to do what you just demonstrated.
Yeah. And when you play, when you learn the melodies and then you start to play them, and this is something I see a lot, like let's take Body and Soul, right? All right, and people will go. You know, they'll put all those cliche kind of lines in there, which isn't necessarily telling you anything about them. It's just that they've listened to enough of people who've played these cliches that they can play them now. So,
you know, it just occurred to me, there's a wonderful video, you may have seen it, with Bill Evans years ago with his brother. And Bill demonstrates, you know, there's certain levels of jazz playing. Here's the way someone who's playing a club date might play it. Here's someone who's, you know, and then he finally says, but if you want a more personal statement, it takes a lot more than doing that. And you have to really investigate. And he goes through every possible permutation of chord and voicing, and then he starts playing, and it's Bill Evans, and he demonstrates that that difference, which I forget the name of the video. It is available, and I think they may even be out on YouTube. But there is a DVD out of maybe the Something Mind of Bill Evans, and it's with he and his brother who was a music educator and I think this was in the 1960s, and he was interviewing Bill about this. But it speaks to the same thing that you're talking about, finding a more personal, less cliched approach to playing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
it's so important.
I just saw that image.
I want to see that.
Yeah. I have it. I'll give it to you.
Okay.
I have it after the interview. I have it here.
Nice.
But continue with that, because I think that's so important.
So say with Body and Soul, like, let's talk about that global versus local approach. If I just stay with something more melodic, the global will give you more opportunity to play melodies over something. So if I'm playing Body and Soul from the beginning, mm-hmm. right? So if I'm playing over the changes, but I'm really just thinking more melodically.
Right.
As opposed to... Right, where I'm really more addressing the chords as they come and for what they are and what the implications are. So I can go either way, and you can go back and forth. I mean, the greatest example of global playing is playing a blues scale over the entire blues, as kids usually do.
Right.
But it's a good way to sort of get into it.
Right.
But you're not taking into account the changes as they happen and how the dominant chords and the thirds and sevenths change. You're just playing this one kind of lick over it.
Right.
But that's like a basic example of global playing.
There's a... If I remember correctly, Ray Ricker had a series of books at which he started in the first book teaching kids how to play over blues just using pentatonics.
Right.
And that would just get them through it, just to give them a feeling of the structure, the 12-bar structure, a feeling of playing with time and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But that global approach, as you've talked about, is a beautiful way to also, like you say, interdisperse with the more sophisticated line playing that you're talking about that is a result of the harmonic implications, you know. But that, again, that's... So how do you, when you're dealing with students, do you break that up into two completely different approaches or for them to practice in that way?
Yeah, sometimes I'll say, okay, for this course, I want you to just play globally. Or I'll say, I want you to only play... Like, take Stella, let's say. Okay, only play notes in the B-flat scale in this next chorus. So you have to think, okay, well, which notes of the B-flat scale work on this chord that's coming up, or the next one? So it forces you to have to deal with the harmony and with an idea, because how simple that is, just staying in a B-flat scale, that is an idea, and we want to develop idea playing, not just running a bunch of notes. And the same thing can be like taking one note and just changing per chord. Like say your idea is as simple as moving upward in by steps, and that's it. And it's interesting how that seems like the simplest thing. You swing along here, dun, 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 and then each time you get a new chord, you have to choose the next note that's appropriate going up a step. It seems simple, but it will throw everybody at some point, because it's like, you know, most of my students will like, they'll get to a point, it's like they end up playing the sus on a dominant chord, or, you know, it'll sound awkward, they'll play the major seven on a dominant, and not because they meant to, but because they just fell into it and they couldn't control where they were. And so that's, we want control all the time over everything that we're doing. It's not like ultra controlling in a sense of like we have no freedom or expression. It's that we always should be in control, and we have to know the song, getting back to just how well we know the song. We have to know it that well that we can do that.
And you can practice this at home, I would think, with, let's say, an Abyssal.
A perfect example, yeah.
You know, instead of just trying to play chorus after chorus, you can really, I'm going to do that tonight.
Set up games for yourself.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to practice at moving what, and I've not heard it referred to as global and local.
I've heard it
melodic or harmonic sometimes,
yeah.
But that's an interesting way of referring to it and phrasing it.
It's going to be in my book.
Are you going to write a book?
Someday, yeah.
Come on!
I'm gathering notes at this point.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. Talk about your choice of instruments, because I think you have some interesting and different choices for instruments than people are typically accustomed to seeing and hearing, and you sound so great on everything that I think it might be healthy for people to know that there is more than just one avenue of picking a specific horn and a model and a mouthpiece and
I mean,
your choices are a little bit atypical in today's world, but you sound so great, no one would even think about it. But I think it would be interesting for the viewers to hear some of the instruments. Talk about what you have here today, for instance.
Well, first of all, we have a friend, Scott Robinson, who almost prides himself on not playing a Mark VI or any instrument that normal people would play, like a Buffet clarinet or whatever. But I think it's just because he actually finds character in those horns. And that's sort of the same for me. You asked about the cigar cutter. I used to have my uncle's old cigar cutter, which got stolen, but it had a certain kind of a ring to it and a certain kind of character, and that's what I look for. I actually enjoy switching horns a lot. There was a period when, this is a late '50s Vito, made by the Vito company when it was in France across the street from Selmer, and it was a competitor, and it was making horns basically, I think, on the level of Selmer and Kahn. And
Johnny Hodges, of course.
He played the model earlier.
Yes.
I like it. It's easy to play. It's in tune. It has a ring to it. I've never been there. It's so funny. You show up on certain gigs and people will like, look at your horn. Oh, you're playing a student model piccolo. I mean, I got that a lot because I, you know, had a student model piccolo for years and I would show up at gigs on and people would be like, or if you didn't have your Mark VI, you know, or, oh, wow, this is on the left, not on the right. How are we going to blend in a section? Or, you know, just stupid stuff like that. I think that is going away a lot because you see a lot of people now finding older instruments, especially Kahn is making a real comeback in the section. People are finding a lot of Kahns, altos and tenors, and they'd love to play. In our section at Jazz Lincoln Center, Sherman Irby, he plays a Berkeley alto. I play a Vito. Walter plays a Kahn. Paul plays a Kahn, and Victor plays a Mark VI. So he's like the only Mark VI guy in a section of five, which is sort of unusual.
And yet you guys blend beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just...
Because that ultimately it's the musician. Yeah. It's the musician that has to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, but it's interesting that, you know, we'd have that kind of diversity in instrument choices and so forth. And I know your choice of mouthpiece is a little different than most people... Well, especially younger players today might not know about Beechler and so forth.
Well, it's funny because when I had some stuff stolen a while back, I don't know if you remember.
I remember.
Of course, I know you remember. You loaned me the best alto mouthpiece I ever played in my life, and you took it back.
the Wellsberg?
No, it was the Meyer.
Meyer, New York. Like I still have that.
I know, such a great mouthpiece.
Yeah.
You were like, okay, give me that back. it helped me get through, tough times.
I remember that period.
The reason I'm playing this mouthpiece, and right now it feels a little hard with this reed, but I'm about a half step harder than I usually am with the three on this nine.
Let's hold it there.
Yeah.
Beechler nine
on
alto. And you heard what Ted sounded like. That, if you just said a Beechler nine on a Vito, The stereotypical perception would be like, get me the next guy. But the point is, you make it work for you, and it fits the way it feels comfortable in your mouth and your body and what you're hearing, and so it's an interesting way of approaching. Like, I'm not going to listen to I'm going to listen to my ears and my body and what feels right for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and the thing is, I used to play a five Beechler with a harder reed. And then you talk about Charles McPherson earlier. I did a gig with him, and he has the most beautiful, free-blowing, easy, bright sound with a lot of character. And I said, what are you playing? He said, a Beechler nine. Maybe he doesn't play that now. But
no, he doesn't.
Okay, but that's what he had on when I did the gig with him.
Wow.
Yeah, and I said, it's so open. He goes, yeah, I just put a soft reed on it. And then Wes Anderson had a Beechler 9 for a little bit, same like the McPherson. And so I said, oh, okay, I've got to get a Beechler 9. So I went out and got a Beechler 9 and put on a 2.5 reed. And I felt like, wow, there's a difference because it's open and not as resistant, but you still don't have to put too much air through it because it's a softer reed. And it felt like a great combination. So I've been playing that ever since. Right now it feels a little hard for me, but it's like what I like about sometimes is if you just open up and let the sound be without pushing too much, you just kind of open up and let that sound, instead of really trying to push it so much, you just like and open up and let the sound be. You can get a little more warmth out of it. I think Beechlers tend to be bright. But I think you can shape it.
Yeah, well, I don't think you, when you play it in the way you normally play it, you don't sound bright. It sounds like a well-balanced overtone series and a beautiful expression.
Yeah, that's cool.
But that's the point. Like, the normal concept for, even if it was a Link 9, it would be like, what? That's got to be loud and bright. And the point is, it's the way the player approaches.
It's true. And
did
this,
you know,
it's
by,
funny,
by the way,
I just want to say one more thing about this horn, because this is the same model as the horn that I use, but my horn is in the equipment truck now, going to our gig that we're doing in than the next gig. So this is one that I haven't played before, really, and it's like identical to my model, and I really like it. It's easy to play.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds great. And what is the choice of clarinet for you these days?
I have a Bouffay. It's an old R13. It's from the 50s or 60s.
Wow, that's a great period.
Is it? I mean, it's a 90-something thousand?
Yeah. That 90,000 would be in the 60s.
Okay, so it's in the 60s.
And that was a very, very great period for Bouffay when it established itself really as the preeminent classical orchestral instrument for many decades.
But can you tell me something? Because people are always saying, well, it's probably blown out. And I keep thinking, oh, maybe this is blown out. But I have a Selmer that has been hardly played. It's an old 40s Selmer that my band director who passed away gave me. And it does have a little different quality to the sound. I'm wondering, like, does a clarinet get blown out? Is that from swabbing it, or what is that?
From playing it. I mean, it does get blown out. It depends. It's different for everyone. For instance, I know Harold Wright, who was the great principal clarinet in the Boston Symphony, used to say that it would be about 7 years, mm-hmm. and the instrument would get blown up. But we're talking about people who played 6-8 hours a day on that instrument, and it would happen. It varies depending on the people playing it, where you play it, your metabolism, how you treat it. Also, a large to do with the barrel, I think. I mean, lot of times switching the barrel frequently, meaning, from even of the same length, maybe once a year or something like that, if you're doing a lot of playing, it can really give the instrument more life. The same thing with the bell. I mean, there's no, I think, fixed thing about blow, but they do blow out.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean blowing out might affect things like pitch and compression of sound or whatnot. It doesn't mean that you still couldn't play it, couldn't use it for certain gigs, and maybe in some ways it might be more favorable for certain types of gigs, blowing gigs. But it's different, from model to model, and unlike a saxophone, which will not, you can have for the rest of your life.
Right.
It's not going to blow out. It might change. It might actually get better. The metal might harden a little bit. But no, the clarinets, piccolos, the same thing. Sometimes there is a certain loss because of the wood. But
So my clarinet's 50 years old. It might be blown out or it might not. But it's still the one that I use. But I really love this old Selmer. And
is it a BT model?
I don't know. It's the octave hole has like a little weird six
thing. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Like, it looks like a nut.
That may be the model right after the BT.
It's got extra keywork for the C sharp and G sharp. I don't know.
An articulated.
I think. It's from the 40s, I believe. Uh-huh. And it's hardly been played, so it's definitely not blown out. But it's got this compact sound that I really, really like.
Yeah.
Plus, it's a little sharper, so I can put I have this B4013 clarinet mouthpiece, which has the most beautiful sound, but I can't use it on my Bouffay. Even on a 64 barrel, it's flat. I can't play. So when I put it on the Selmer, I feel like the combination of the Selmer and this mouthpiece, I feel like I have the best sound that I have. But technically it's a little awkward for me to play, and it's not as in tune as my Bouffay. That's the only thing.
That's always the trade-off with instruments, the same thing. What about your flute piccolo setup? What do you tend to?
Yeah, I like a darker sound, I guess. So the flute is a Haynes from the 50s, which I don't know if it has a thicker wall or what, but when I play a modern flute, it always feels too thin for me. I feel like it doesn't take my sound.
I think that's also largely to do, yes, maybe the weight and the undercutting, but also the head joints and the Haynes instruments in the 50s, 60s were magnificent instruments.
I love my flute.
Yeah.
Man. It's a low B open hole.
Yeah.
I close up the G because it's in line and I can't cover it. But it's got a really dark, warm sound. And if I'm feeling pretty on top of my embouchure and stuff like that, I can get it to ring pretty well and get a pretty good vibration out of it. Yeah. My piccolo is an old, it's from the early 80s. It's a wooden Haynes from the early 80s, which I bought because I was doing Le Cage aux Folles, which you subbed for me on, which had the hardest piccolo stuff I had ever, I don't think I ever played that right.
I thought, there are a few shows like that where they write piccolo stuff that probably only the maybe my wife could do it. She's a great piccolo player. So, but I mean, it's almost absurd.
I could never play. And the funny thing is that, and just going back to the show thing, is that I first got, well, Cats was kind of a fluke. I mean, I fell into that gig. But after that, the next show that I had was just real sax heavy. It was basically because it had all these alto solos. And that's why I was called to do it, not because of my doubling. And then I kept taking shows from the same contractor. And the sax got less and less. And it got more, it was always the first woodwind book, so it'd be piccolo and flute for the most part. That's right. All you played.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, this is, but that helped a lot. Helped me get my piccolo chops a little bit more together. So right. I have this wooden Haynes. It's got a little resistance to it and yes. sort of a darkness to it. That's what I like. That's what I played on the Mancini record. Yeah.
That's great. Well, that's an interesting take on your, because some of the instruments, the Haynes, a lot of players in New York play them, although it's in the classical world today, flute playing, not as many play Haynes as they used to be. Buffets are still popular in the classical world, of course, and there are many other models that are used as well.
Right.
I think the fact is that you're not adhering to any what is the modern trend. You're using your basic musical gut and intuition and saying what makes me feel good and what makes me get the sound that I'm hearing.
Well, that's what it should be anyway. It's a mouthpiece yes. or a horn or anything. It shouldn't be about, you know, are people going to look at me funny when I walk in? They'll look at you funny if... because of your equipment, you don't sound good. Yeah, I understand that.
Right.
But like I said, Scott Robinson, I mean, he's got a clarinet made out of an airplane propeller.
What? Really?
Yeah, it's made out of plywood. And it's cool, and it sounds good. And his bass clarinet's metal. I mean, it just like, and there's a quirky side to Scott, too.
Yeah, it's almost... Yeah, you think?
One time I came into Maria Schneider's band at Visioni's way back, and he took a solo on a C melody. And he came up to me, I said, yeah, that sounded pretty good for a lamp.
Well, he's a unique musician and a spectacular one as well. I just want to wrap up with a few statements. One, Ted has a number of video clips out on YouTube now that were done by Jazz at Lincoln Center Jazz Academy, which are tremendously valuable. They're about 5 or 6 minutes, and he addresses each of them, and he addresses a number of subjects, including using the piano as a practice tool, talking about harmony, about getting at one with your instrument, and I think they're tremendously valuable. So all of you who are watching this video, I hope you will also go to YouTube and check out Ted's other videos. They're very helpful. Can you talk about what other projects you personally have now that you're a Grammy Award winning, big band writer and all? Do you have any other projects, unique things coming up?
Yeah, my next big band record, I'm not going to talk about the theme of it, but... I haven't started writing it yet, but I'm kind of working with the idea of what that will be, and that'll be my next. It could be my next release, or maybe one after. I'm not sure yet. Right now, I have to finish a couple. I have an assignment. Eddie Daniels is doing a record of all Gismonti songs, and I'm doing 5 arrangements for a string quartet and jazz quartet.
Wow!
So,
wow!
Yeah, and Eddie's one of the people that I first met when I moved to New York, and he's maybe one of the greatest clarinet players that has ever lived. And I had an opportunity. Victor Goines and I went over to his house.
He told me.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Yeah, he played for 3 hours, the three of us on clarinets. And it was so great. But anyway, so he's doing this project. I've got to finish 5 arrangements for that group. And then the commission for a band in Canada. But I love being creative. And it's, for me, getting an award is amazing. It really is, because that's considered the highest honor in the music world.
Right.
And it's funny how if it creates more opportunities for me, that would be great.
Yes.
As far as what it means to me, I already did the work. I already did the creativity. It doesn't feel like, because it's 2 years after I've written the music. I mean, we put a lot of work into the packaging and doing all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's like, wow, that's, even though that just happened a week ago, it feels like old news to me because I created that music so long ago.
Right.
So for me, it's always just trying to be as creative as possible and create situations where I can continue to be as creative as possible, and then I'm happy. I've never had a huge goal to be rich or famous or any of those things or whatever. It's just to be able to do what I love to do. I mean, you know that, that feeling. And so I love wine. I have a partner in wine. I call her Kristen Lee Sargent, who's a jazz singer. We've released a wine recently. We actually worked with a winery in California, and we have our first vintage out. And it's in a few places in New York.
And now, what's it called again?
Two Notes.
Two Notes.
Yeah.
Little, spell that as T-W-O?
T-W-O, notes. Two Notes. And it's a Cabernet Sauvignon dominant sort of Bordeaux style blend that's from California. And it's delicious. I mean, I like drinking wine.
Okay.
So I've made my own. But it's sort of like the cobbler's kids don't have any shoes. It's like I can't actually afford to buy, to have a lot of it. But anyway, no, so that's it. I like to write. I've been working on a screenplay based on some of my family experiences. In the 60s, late 60s, when my family were civil rights activists and was civil rights activists and some involvements with some people. So just, I like doing different things. And maybe like you asked about the tenor and the alto and all that, it's such a specific difference, but I feel like I like just doing lots of different things. And
yeah, well, that's obvious, and you've been successful at so many different things. And what could we leave younger players today who are high school and college, or even just out of school and looking to break into the music business? What advice would you offer them, given this, you know, the nature of our world, the nature of our business today?
I think, well, on the artistic side, I think while we're in high school and college, we should be really focusing on developing as much flexibility and understanding and background and all the different styles of music. I think it's one thing to just say, okay, I'm an alto player and I'm only listening to Kenny Garrett, who's like one of the greatest alto players, but you've got to check out everybody else. And I think that preparing yourself for earning a living in music is going to be very, very important. So it does mean having your doubles at a level where you can come in and do gigs, whether it's, you don't have to sound like Julius Baker on a flute or a Joffe on a flute. You have to sound good enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you do, but at the same point, you might make a decision, I don't want to do commercial music. Then you have to be completely committed to your art form, and you have to create an environment for yourself. When I was with a group of musicians, Frank Kimbrough, Ben Allison, Michael Blake, and Ron Horton, and we created something called the Jazz Composers Collective because we didn't find that we were doing enough of the creative work we wanted to do. So we just started this forum for composition, and we started putting on concerts, and it took us 5 years to even get our first write-up press, and continued for 13 years. And out of that came a lot of great recordings and everything. So it's like you have to create and find the people you love to play with, create an environment, and always take yourself very seriously as an artist, but also come with a lot of humility and willingness to learn and to learn from the people who are older than you and have been around. Always look at the positive. When you go hear a band, don't say, man, this guy sucks, or this guy sounds like this, or he can't play. Say, man, I really like the way he played that phrase, or I like his sound, or he's really committed to this, and I can learn from that. There's always something to learn from, and I think you have to come into every situation with that sort of humility, and that will allow you to absorb and grow and learn. Always go up to the people you admire and talk to them, get with them, hang out, find out when they are rehearsing, come and hang out. People do that, and they become part of a scene. And also, when you have that childlike sort of absorption, you get better faster. So I think just in general, I mean, that's the advice that I would give. But it's tough, and you make a choice, but you got to be 100% committed to it.
It's great advice, Ted, and you certainly have had the career that defines that approach. And one of the reasons you've been able to move so effortlessly between commercial music, classical music, jazz music, small group player, big band player, composer, arranger, I think is reflective of that attitude. Mm. And it's been an inspiration for me, and I really appreciate you spending time today sharing it with our audience. And time to go have lunch, my friend.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you
for having me.
Yeah. And thank you for tuning in. Our next video interview will be with a very unique individual who is, I guess, defines the idea of Renaissance man. His name is Dr. Ronnie Odrich, and is one of the greatest jazz clarinet players in the world, also one of the top periodontal surgeons. And there's a lot for us to learn from Dr. Odrich. So we'll see you next time on the Woodwind Legacy series. Thank you.